వక్రతుండ మహాకాయ సూర్యకోటి సమప్రభ నిర్విఘ్నం కురు మే దేవ సర్వకార్యషు సర్వదా. శివశక్త్యా యుక్తో యది భవతి శక్తః ప్రభవితుం న చేదేవం దేవో న ఖలు కుశలః స్పందితుమపి. అత స్వామారాధ్యా హరిహర విరించాదిభిరపి ప్రణంతుం స్తోతుం వా కతమకృత పుణ్యః ప్రభవతి.
Sri Sai Ram. At the outset, my most loving and prayerful salutations at the divine lotus feet of our most beloved Bhagwan, Sri Satya Sai Baba. Dear listener, you are tuned to Radio Sai Global Harmony on Asia Stream, bringing you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the love and the message of Bhagwan Sri Satya Sai Baba. Good morning, greetings and loving Sai Ram on this Thursday on the 25th of June 2020, and with me Team Radio Sai Sunil welcoming you to this morning segment Divine Glory on Thursday live from Prashanti Nilayam. Before I read out to you today's Sai Inspires message, let me briefly tell you that Radio Sai office now has a new name. And it is Sri Satya Sai Media Center, a division of the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust, Prashanti Nilayam. Yesterday, the trustees of the Sri Satya Sai Central Trust offered this upgraded facility to Bhagwan in a small function held here at Prashanti Nilayam. And this upgraded facility has a new audio recording studio, a dedicated broadcast studio from where I'm speaking to you right now, and an upgraded video studio and workstations. Thanking Bhagwan for giving all of us this wonderful opportunity for working in this upgraded facility of the Sri Satya Sai Media Center here at Prashanti Nilayam, let me now read out to you today's Sai Inspires message. What is the essence of true education? Bhagwan lovingly explains to us today, and I quote, "The leaf plate on which a full lunch is served will lie low on the floor. The leaf plate on which nothing is placed will hop high with every gust of wind." Thus says the proverb. So too, the person who has much scholarship and many skills will lead an unassuming life. But one who has not derived genuine education and the strength it can confer lives in pomp and pride. That person struggles to hide defects from being known to others, and in the end, the struggles don't succeed. One meets with double ruin. One doesn't experience spiritual bliss or ananda, and one doesn't impart it to others. In the end, one becomes the target of ridicule. Therefore, don't allow the desire for ostentation to enter the mind. Don't allow egotism to approach you. Be humble and be loyal to high ideals. Only then can you serve the cause of world peace and prosperity. Unquote. This was taken from Vidya Vahini, chapter 15. Dear listener, today as the world is continuing with lockdowns and social distancing due to the spread of the coronavirus disease or the COVID-19, let us all continue to take all the precautions mandated by the government and the health department, and also maintain personal and community hygiene, and also let us continue to engage in prayers at our own places for world peace. And let me now play for you a mantra or the verse from Krishna Yajurveda Taittiriya Aranyaka, and the efficacy of this mantra is in destroying all the harmful germs and viruses.
Om Atrinatva Krime Hanmi Kanvena Jamadagnina Vishvavaso Brahmana Hataha Krimina Gumraja Apyesha Vistapatir Hataha Atho Mata Atho Pita Atho Sthura Atho Kshudra Atho Krishna Atho Shveta Atho Ashatika Hata Shveta Bhissaha Sarve Hata Aharavadya Shrutasya Havisho Yata Tat Satyam Yadamuyamasya Jambhayo Adadhamita Dahitate Khanpanrasi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Dear listener, that was the mantra from Krishna Yajurveda Taittiriya Aranyaka, and the efficacy of this mantra is in destroying all the harmful germs. And this mantra is chanted daily in the morning and evening mandir prayer sessions here at Prashanti Nilayam. And for those of you who don't know, let me tell you that these prayer sessions are streamed live for all to listen on Radio Sai's Prashanti Mandir Live YouTube channel, Sri Satya Sai Baba Facebook page, and of course Radio Sai's Asia stream and Telugu streams, both in the morning at 8 a.m. and in the evening at 5 p.m. So you could log on at these times. The time right now in our studios is 51 minutes past 9 a.m. That is Indian Standard Time. And today in Divine Glory, I've lined up for you readings from the English version of the holy book Sri Sai Satcharitra by Sri Hemant Pant, followed by a conversation with Dr. Samuel Sanvis, a psychiatrist from the United States of America, taken from our archives. And in conversation with Dr. Samuel Sanvis is Professor J. Venkatraman, the former Vice Chancellor of the Sri Satya Sai Institute of Higher Learning and also the former Director of Radio Sai. But first, readings from Sri Sai Satcharitra. Sri Sai Satcharitra is an account on the life and teachings of Sai Baba of Shirdi, written by Sri Hemant Pant. We are thankful to Vasanti Sundaram for reading out the contents from this holy book, and to Veeramani Kannan for the melodious musical support. Wishing you all a happy, holy and blessed Thursday and a wonderful day ahead. Praying to Lord Almighty that the pandemic caused by the coronavirus disease be eradicated and all the suffering come to an end at the earliest. Samasta lokaha sukhino bhavantu.
Chapter 36. Wonderful Stories of the Two Goa Gentlemen, Mrs. Aurangabadkar. This chapter relates the wonderful stories of two gentlemen from Goa and Mrs. Aurangabadkar of Solapur. two gentlemen. Once, two gentlemen came from Goa for taking darshan of Sai Baba and prostrated themselves before him. Though both came together, Baba asked only one of them to give him 15 rupees as dakshina, which was paid willingly. The other man voluntarily offered 35 rupees, which was rejected by Baba to the astonishment of all. Shama, who was present, asked Baba, "What is this? Both came together. One's dakshina you accept, the others, though voluntarily paid, you refuse. Why this distinction?" Baba replied, "Shama, you know nothing. I take nothing from anybody. The Masjid Mai calls for the debt. The donor pays it and becomes free. Have I any home, property or family to look after? I require nothing. I am ever free. Debt, enmity and murder have to be atoned for, as there is no escape from them." Baba then continued in his characteristic way as follows. At first he was poor and took a vow to his God that he would pay his first month's salary if he got a job. He got one for 15 rupees per month. Then he steadily got promotions. From 15 rupees he got 30, 60, 100, 200 and ultimately 700 rupees per month. But in his prosperity, he forgot completely the vow he took. The force of his karma has driven him here, and I ask that amount of 15 rupees from him as dakshina. Another story. While wandering by the seaside, I came to a huge mansion and sat on its veranda. The Brahmin owner gave me a good reception and fed me sumptuously. He showed me a neat and clean place near a cupboard for sleeping. I slept there. While I was sound asleep, the man removed a laterite slab and broke the wall, crept in and scissored off all the money from my pocket. When I woke up, I found that 30,000 rupees were stolen. I was greatly distressed and sat weeping and mourning. The money was in currency notes and I thought that the Brahmin had stolen it. I lost all interest in food and drink and sat for a fortnight on the veranda bemoaning my loss. After the fortnight was over, a passing fakir saw me crying and made inquiries regarding the cause of my sorrow. I told him everything. He said, "If you act according to my bidding, you will recover your money. Go to a fakir. I shall give his whereabouts. Surrender yourself to him. He will get your money back. In the meanwhile, give up your favorite food till you recover your money." I followed the fakir's advice and got my money. Then went to the seashore where a steamer was standing, but I could not get into it as it was overcrowded. There, a good-natured man interceded for me and I got in, luckily. That brought me to another shore, from where I caught a train and came to the Masjid Mai. The story finished, and Baba asked Shama to take the guests and arrange for their feeding. Then Shama took them home and fed them. At dinner, Shama said to the guests that Baba's story was rather mysterious, as he had never gone to the seaside, never had any money, never travelled, never lost any money, and never recovered it, and inquired from them whether they understood it and caught its significance. The guests were deeply moved and were shedding tears. In a choked voice they said that Baba was omniscient, infinite, the Supreme One, without a second. The story he gave out is exactly our story. What he spoke has already taken place in our case. How did he know of this? It's a wonder of wonders. We shall give all the details after the meals. Then, after the meals, while they were chewing betel leaves, the guests began to tell their stories. One of them said, "A hill station on the Ghats is my native place. I went to Goa to earn my living by securing a job. I took a vow to God Datta that if I got any service, I would offer him my first month's salary. By his grace, I got a job of 15 rupees and then I got promotions as described by Baba. I did forget all about my vow. Baba has just reminded me of it in this way and recovered 15 rupees from me. It is not dakshina as one may think of it, but a repayment of an old debt and fulfillment of a long forgotten vow. Moral. In fact, Baba never begged for any money, nor allowed his bhaktas to beg. He regarded money as a danger or bar to spiritual progress and did not allow his bhaktas to fall into its clutches. Bhagat Mahasapati is a case in point. He was very poor and could hardly make both ends meet. Baba never allowed him to make any money nor gave him anything from the dakshina collection. Once, a kind and liberal merchant named Hansraj gave a large amount of money to Mahasapati in Baba's presence, but Baba did not permit him to accept it. Then the second guest began his tale. My Brahmin cook was serving me faithfully for 35 years. Unfortunately, he fell into bad ways, his mind changed, and he robbed me of my treasure. By removing a laterite slab from my wall where my cupboard is fixed, he came in while we were all deep asleep and carried away all my accumulated wealth, 30,000 rupees in currency notes. I do not know how Baba mentioned the exact amount. I sat crying day and night. My inquiries came to nothing. I spent a fortnight in great anxiety. As I sat on the veranda, sad and dejected, a passing fakir saw my condition and inquired of its cause, and I told him all about it. He told me that an awaliya by name Sai lives in Shirdi, Kopargaon Taluk. Make a vow to him and give up any food that you like best and say to him mentally that I have given up eating that food till I take your darshan. Then I took the vow and gave up eating rice and said, Baba, I'll eat it after recovering my property and after taking your darshan. 15 days passed after this. The Brahmin of his own accord came to me, returned my money and apologized, saying, I went mad and acted thus. I now place my head on your feet. Please forgive me. Thus everything ended well. The fakir that met me and helped me was not seen again. An intensive desire to see Sai Baba, whom the fakir pointed out to me, arose in my mind. I thought the fakir who came all the way to my house was no other than Sai Baba. Would he who saw me and helped me to get my lost money ever covet to get 35 rupees? On the contrary, without expecting anything from us, he always leads us on the path of spiritual progress. I was overjoyed when I recovered my stolen property, and being ignorant, I forgot all about my vow. Then, when I went to Kulaba, one night I saw Sai Baba in my dream. This reminded me of my promised visit to Shirdi. I went to Goa, and from there wanted to start for Shirdi by taking a steamer to Mumbai en route. But when I came to the harbour, I found the steamer was crowded and there was no place. The captain did not allow me, but on the intercession of a peon who was a stranger to me, I was allowed to get into the steamer which brought me to Mumbai. From there, I came by train. Surely I think that Baba is all-pervading and all-knowing. What are we and where is our home? How fortunate we are that Baba got our money back and drew us here to himself. Shirdi folks must be infinitely superior and more fortunate than we, for Baba has played, laughed, talked and lived with you all for so many years. I think that your store of good merits must be infinite. Sai is our Datta, Lord Dattatreya. He gave me a seat in the steamer and brought me here, and thus gave proof of his omniscience and omnipotence. Mrs. Aurangabadkar. A lady from Sholapur, the wife of Sakharam Aurangabadkar, had no issue during the long period of 27 years. She had made a number of vows to gods and goddesses for an issue, but was not successful. She then became almost hopeless. To make a last attempt in this matter, she came to Shirdi with her stepson Vishwanath and stayed there for 2 months serving Baba. Whenever she went to the masjid, she found Baba surrounded by devotees. She wanted to see Baba alone, fall at his feet and open her heart and pray for an issue. But she did not get any suitable opportunity. Ultimately, she requested Shama to intercede with Baba for her when he was alone. Shama said to her that Baba's darbar was open. Still, he would try for her and that the Lord might bless her. He asked her to sit ready with a coconut and joss sticks in the open courtyard at the time of Baba's meals, and that when he beckoned to her, she should come up. One day, after dinner, when Shama was wiping Baba's wet hands with a towel, the latter pinched Shama's cheek. Shama, feigning anger, said, "Deva, is it proper for you to pinch me like this? We don't want such a mischievous God who pinches us like this. Are we your dependents? This is the fruit of our intimacy?" Baba replied, "O Shama, during the 72 generations that you were with me, I never pinched you till now. And now you resent my touching you?" Shama replied, "I want a God who will always love us and give us new dishes to eat. We do not want any reward from you or heaven. Let our faith unto your feet be ever awake." Baba said, "Yes, I have indeed come for that. I have been feeding and nursing you and have got great love and affection for you." Then Baba went up and took his seat. Shama beckoned to the lady. She came up, bowed down, and presented the coconut and joss sticks. Baba shook the coconut, which was dry. The kernel within rolled and made a noise. Baba said, "Shama, this is rolling. See what it says?" Shama: "The woman prays that a child should similarly roll in her womb. So please give her the coconut with your blessing." Baba said, "Will the coconut give her any issue? How foolish people are to fancy such things." Shama said, "I know the power of your words and blessing. Your word will give her a series of children. You're wrangling and not giving real blessing." The parley went on for a while. Baba repeatedly ordered to break the coconut, and Shama pleaded for the gift of the entire fruit to the lady. Finally, Baba yielded and said, "She will have an issue." Shama asked, "When?" Baba said, "In 12 months. At this, the coconut was broken into two parts. One was eaten by the two, the other was given to the lady. Then Shama turned up to the lady and said, "Dear lady, you are a witness to my words. If within 12 months you do not get a child, I will break a coconut against this Deva's head and drive him out of this masjid. If I fail in this, I will not call myself Madhav. You will soon realize what I say." The lady delivered a son in a year's time, and the son was brought to Baba in his 5th month. The couple, both husband and wife, prostrated before Baba, and the grateful father paid a sum of 500 rupees, which was spent in constructing a shed for Baba's horse, Shyam Karna. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Chapter 37. Chavadi Procession. In this chapter, Hemad Pant, after making some preliminary observations on some points of Vedanta, describes the Chavadi Procession. Preliminary. Blessed is Sai's life for his devotees. Blessed is his daily routine. His ways and actions are indescribable. Sometimes he was intoxicated with Brahmanand, divine bliss, and at other times completely self-absorbed. While doing so many things at the same time, he was yet unconcerned with them. Though he seemed at times quite inactive, he was not idle or dozing. He always abided in his own self. Though he looked calm and placid as a sea, he was deep and unfathomable. Who can describe his ineffable nature? He regarded men as brothers, women as sisters and mothers. He was a perfect celibate, as everybody knows. May the knowledge we got in his company last long unto death. Let us ever serve him with wholehearted devotion to his feet. Let us see him in all beings and let us constantly remember his name. Hemad Pant, after making some lengthy dissertations on some topics of Vedanta, which he himself considers as a digression, goes on to describe the Chavadi procession. Chavadi procession. Baba's dormitory has already been described. One day he slept in the masjid and on the next in the Chavadi near the masjid. He slept in the masjid and in the Chavadi in alternate days. This alternate sleeping at both these places went on till Baba's Mahasamadhi. From 10th December 1909, devotees began to offer regular worship to Baba in the Chavadi. This we will now describe with his grace. When the day of retiring to the Chavadi came, people flocked to the masjid and did bhajan in the mandap for a few hours. Behind them was a beautiful palanquin, to the right a Tulsi Vrindavan, and in front Baba adorned his seat and there were devotees singing bhajans. Men and women who had a liking for the bhajan came in time. Some took tal, chiplis and kartal, mridang, khanjiri and ghol, all in the hands and conducted the bhajan. Sai Baba was the magnet. He drew all the devotees to him. Outside in the open, some trimmed the devatyas, some decorated the palanquin, and some stood with cane sticks in their hands and hailed victory to Baba. The corners were decorated with buntings. In the masjid, rows of burning oil lamps shed their light. Baba's horse, Shyamkarna, stood fully decorated outside. Then Tatya Patil came with a group of men to Baba and asked him to be ready. Baba sat quiet in his place till Tatya came and helped him get up by putting his arm under Baba's arm. Tatya called Baba by the name of Mama or maternal uncle. Really, their relationship was extremely intimate. Baba wore on his body the usual kafni, took his satka under his armpit, and after taking his chilim and tobacco and placing a cloth over his shoulder, became ready to start. Then Tatya placed a golden embroidered beautiful shela or shawl over his body. After this, Baba himself put a few fuel sticks in the dhuni to keep it alive and with his right hand extinguished the lamp burning near the dhuni and then started for the Chavadi. Then all sorts of musical instruments, band and horns gave out different sounds and the fireworks exhibited various colored views. Men and women singing Baba's name started walking, doing bhajan to the accompaniment of mridang and veena. Some danced with joy and some carried various flags. The bhaldars announced Baba's name when he came on the steps of the masjid. On the two sides of Baba stood persons who held chamar and others who fanned Baba. On the way were spread folds of cloth which Baba walked on. Being supported by devotees' hands, Tatya Patil held the left hand and Mahal Sapati the right, and Bapu Sahib Jog held the chhatra or the umbrella over his head. In this fashion Baba marched on to the Chavadi. The fully decorated horse named Shyamkarna led the way, and behind him were all the carriers, waiters, musical players and the crowd of devotees. Harinam, the name of Lord, was being chanted to the accompaniment of music as also the name of Sai. In this manner, the procession reached the corner and everyone joined the party, seemed pleased and delighted. On reaching this corner, Baba stood facing the Chavadi and shone with a peculiar aura. It seemed as if the face of Baba took over the glory of the rising sun. Baba stood there with a concentrated mind, facing the north, as if he was signaling something. All the instruments played music while Baba moved his right hand up and down for some time. Kaka Sahib Dikshit at this time came forward with a silver plate containing flowers smeared with gulal and threw them on Baba's body off and on. The musical instruments played the best at this juncture and Baba's face beamed with radiance and beauty, and all the persons viewed this luster to their heart's content. Words fail to describe the splendor of the scene. Sometimes Mahal Sapati began to dance, as if possessed by some deity, but all were surprised to see that Baba's concentration was least disturbed. With a lantern in his hand, Tatya Patil walked on Baba's left side and Bhagat Mahalsapati on the right, holding in his hand the hem of Baba's garment. What a beautiful procession and what an expression of devotion. To witness this, men and women, poor and rich, flocked there. Baba walked at a very slow pace. Bhaktas followed on both sides with love and devotion. With joy permeating the whole atmosphere of the place, the procession reached the Chavadi. Those days are gone now. Nobody can see them in the future. But by remembering and visualizing that sight, we can bring solace and ecstasy to our minds. The Chavadi was also fully decorated with a good white ceiling mirrors and many sorts of lamps. On reaching there, Tatya went ahead and spread an asan and placing a bolster, made Baba sit there and made him wear angharka. Then the devotees worshipped him in various ways. They put a crown on his head with a tuft of bark, placed garlands of flowers and jewels around his neck, and marking his forehead with musk mixed vertical lines, they gazed at him for long to their heart's content. They changed his headdress now and then, held it aloft on the head, fearing that Baba might throw it away. Baba knew what the bhaktas wished for and meekly submitted to all their ways without objection. With these adornments, he looked wonderful and beautiful. Nana Sahib Nimonkar held the chhatra with its beautiful pendants which moved in a circle with its supporting stick. Bapu Sahib Jog washed his feet in a silver dish, offered argya and worship with due formalities, then smeared his arms with chandan paste and offered him tambul. Baba sat on the asan while Tatya and others kept standing. When Baba sat on the gaddi, supporting himself against the bolster, devotees on both sides waved chamars and fans. Shama then prepared the chilim and handed it over to Tatya Patil, who drew a flame out of it by inhaling a deep breath through his mouth and then gave it to Baba. After Baba had a smoke, it was given to Bhagat Mahalsapati and then it was passed round to all. Blessed was the inanimate chilim. It had first to undergo many ordeals of penance, such as being kneaded by potmakers, dried in the sun and burnt in the fire. And then it had the good fortune to get the contact of Baba's hand and his kiss. After this function was over, devotees put garlands of flowers around his neck and gave him scent and bunches of flowers. Baba, who was an incarnation of dispassion, cared a fig for all these necklaces of jewels and garlands of flowers and other decorations. But out of real love to his devotees, he allowed them to have their own way and to please themselves. Finally, Bapu Sahib Jog waved the arati over Baba, observing all formalities, and the musical instruments played their auspicious tunes. When this arati was over, the devotees returned home, one by one saluting Baba and taking his leave. When Tatya Patil, after offering chilim, attar and rose water, stood to depart, Baba said to him lovingly, "Guard me properly. Go if you like, but return sometimes at night and inquire for me." On replying in the affirmative, Tatya Patil left the Chavadi and went home. Then Baba himself prepared his bed. He arranged some sheets one upon another and thus making his bed, went to rest. We shall also now take rest and close this chapter with a request to the readers that they should remember Baba and his Chavadi procession daily before they retire and go to bed. Bow to Sri Sai. Peace be to all.
Sai Ram, and welcome Professor Sandweiss to the studios of Radio Sai. Well, I must ask you, how does it feel to be in our studio? Did you ever dream you would be in such a studio at any time?
You know, it's remarkable coming to see Swami and experiencing his greatness. And yet, we're in a setting that is like years back. We're in a little cow pasture. So to see all of this grow up is extraordinary. To see it grow up and blossom, and to see modern equipment being devoted to such a holy task, it was wonderful to see.
As a matter of fact, 6 months ago, if somebody had told me, "Listen, you would be talking to Professor Sandweiss for the radio," I would have thought it as a great joke, but here it is happening. And do you know, our service is now being heard all the way from Kuwait to Philippines. And very soon it will be heard in Europe and Africa.
My goodness, it's chilling.
And this thing has happened all of a sudden. That's the way it saw me.
Let me correct you, though. I'm not really a professor. I'm an assistant clinical professor back at the University of California, San Diego. But really, probably better to refer to me as a doctor, because I don't really do a lot of teaching at this point.
But you know, in the Army, everybody's a general, even though you may be a
brigadier. Well, then go ahead once I make this.
All right. Maybe I'll call you Sam, but maybe it won't be necessary also.
Right.
You are a product of the West, and you are an academic. You practice medicine, you practice psychiatry, and you are associated with a very respected university. So the question that most people would like to ask is, how about telling us how you came to Swami? Because, you know, this is supposed to be something that is unimaginable, inconceivable, according to normal people.
Yes.
But it happens. How did it happen in your case? Okay. Briefly.
Just a quick aside. I wouldn't consider myself an academic. I'm not heavily intellectual like that, nor do I spend much time teaching. I'm inquisitive, and I am thoughtful, and I've thought a lot about Swami and his relationship to Western behavioral sciences and psychiatry, but I wouldn't consider myself an academic. How did I come to Swami? Because probably it's hard for me to understand from this life, so one must posit that there's been other lifetimes that prepared me, because here I am stuck in a Western culture.
You're the first person I've heard say that.
Well, it's probably because I can't understand why I would have the good fortune, especially coming from the West, where this kind of thinking isn't well recognized, the kind of thinking we're going to talk about. Even in Western psychiatry, it's quite unusual to think this way, to think Vedantic thoughts. But I must have felt from very early on, I could recognize a great inquiry why I am alive and why this world and why I'm in such a extraordinary game. It just didn't seem, I didn't take it as if it was a natural thing. I just was amazed at it all the time. I wondered why.
At what period of your life was that?
I think very early. I could remember walking down the street at about 11 years or 12 years old, thinking thoughts
as
about
early as that. That's very unusual.
Well, I don't know. Children are, they can be very innocent and very pure, and maybe
absolutely.
They at early age do have thoughts like this, and then they're educated out of them.
That's a good one.
So this idea of what is the purpose of life and all, it naturally led me to reading spiritual books and mystical books, and I was very interested in saints and sages and this level of knowledge that they had that was beyond general worldly knowledge. So I thought, since I was born in a medical family and it was our tradition to go into medicine, and I was told by my father probably in my first day of life that you will be a doctor, I went into medicine and found an area that was closest that would allow me to think about spiritual matters, and that was psychiatry. After 9 years in the practice of psychiatry, I could see that the questions I was asking was not answered in the field of psychiatry, so I began to ask the question. I remember almost to the day to people, have you ever seen a miracle? Because I had been with all of these intellectuals, and I'd heard enough theory and ideas that that wouldn't convince me. I just wondered, is there anybody that knows anything at a higher level and can show it by some kind of manifestation of something? That's how I was thinking.
You mean you thought miracles might be possible? You just didn't take it for granted that miracles are impossible, as most university-educated people do?
Oh, well, because I was, throughout my education, reading these books on mysticism, Jewish mysticism, Zen Buddhist, Zen swordsman that had a sixth sense, and these kinds of stories and feeling that... that high souls had one foot in this life and another in another dimension, and that they could see and they could experience and they had vast wisdom. This thrilled me, that there was this level of understanding that transcended time and it was infinite and brought us into a very high elevated state, that we were much higher than what I considered from a Western point of view. Godly in some way. So I was always searching, but if I ever told my professors at in medical school or in my residency in psychiatry that I was wondering like this, and one time I did slip and ask about that I'm interested, I put it this way, I'm interested in hypnosis and other levels of consciousness. And they looked at me very seriously. I thought they were going to send me down for a checkup. So I stopped asking those questions. But once I got out, I did experiment. I did wonder, well, what is a spiritual kind of therapy, and what are the other therapies besides the classical ones we're looking at? And I finally, I think, fatigued myself and began to ask the simple question, have you ever seen a miracle, something beyond what we understand as reality? Within 2 or 3 weeks, I heard about Sai Baba, and within about 2 months, I was in India. That's how quick it took.
It happened very fast.
Yes.
And which year was that?
That was May of 1972.
You remember very well.
Yes.
And May of 1972, May is a rather difficult month to be in India.
Well, there are many reasons it's difficult for a young Western psychiatrist. Coming over, I heard that it wasn't me going to see Sai Baba. It was his devotees were saying he was bringing you.
Did you believe it?
Of course not. At that time, I thought that was psychotic thinking, because the only place I heard thinking like that was by paranoid people who thought that there were other dimensions of unreality. But I was coming into a strange country, and of course I had done some traveling, and that was exciting for me also, but it was a bit of a shock.
And when you saw Swami, you saw a miracle after some waiting?
Not after some waiting. I came to Bombay, and he was going to be giving darshan at a large stadium. A devotee invited me to the outskirts of town, where I could have a little tea and rest before I took a taxi to the field. And after I rested, I got up to go, and as I left this little apartment, Swami passed me and went inside the apartment.
Oh, in the apartment?
It was a 9-story apartment.
Oh, he had come to that building.
He came exactly to that building. This was way in the outskirts of Bombay. I was skeptical. I was not a devotee. I was a very inquisitive Western psychiatrist. And I'm leaving this little building way in the suburbs of, Bombay's large place. So to pass him that way, in such a timely way, and without a look or anything, he just passed me and went into this building. I turned and ran after him like I was a crazy man, and I wasn't even a devotee. But I knew he shocked my belief system so that I could think that, my God, was he bringing me to him? How could such a chance occurrence happen like this? This is the only time it ever happened in my life like this.
By the way, do you know what Swami says about coincidence? He says, coincidence is a miracle where I hide myself.
Well,
okay, carry on.
Well, this was a coincidence in which he didn't hide himself.
Yeah,
it was right there, and I was very much taken with it. I saw him for the first time, and I was not impressed. He seemed like a man relatively small in stature, and everybody was very, very respectful and reverent to him. And that was my first contact. He left the building. I went to the to the stadium. And while I was, I came late, and so I was outside the stadium. It was packed, and Swami was way in the middle of the stadium. And he just slowly walked in my direction and walked all the way up to about 15, 20 feet from me, and then just stood in this kind of blissful state. And I thought, my goodness, that was an unusual occurrence also. So he was warming me up.
Mm-hmm.
From there, there were many... I wanted to see a miracle, and I could see that he materialized an object for me. I saw it close. I came during the time of his first summer school.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first time they had the summer school, and it was at Vrindavan, and it was in back of an old house. Now they have this tree at Vrindavan. Mm-hmm. And it was made up of a sort of a thatched roof, and there were monkeys hopping on the roof and all of that. I think the first teaching that Swami gave me in the course of this summer school, I was sitting watching, and I was with a person who was sort of, he'd been there about 8 years, and he was telling me some of the things that were happening. And so we were sitting, and it was hot, and he put his legs up on the chair in front of him and just rested back like this. And all of a sudden, he felt somebody's feet on his chair, and I could see his chair rocking back and forth like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we turned around, and it was Swami sitting in the chair and back, showing him how it felt to the person in front of him. That was the first lesson I had from Swami. It was really quite warming that he was teaching us, you know, do unto others as you'd like them to do unto you. And I was infatuated by him. We had lunch with him, and he served everybody. And he served without any pretense, as if he was just a humble. He was immediate, and he was alive, and he was truly humble, and truly a servant. And I couldn't get over that. How he fed everybody. And one day I started listening to what he had to say. This really is like at the core of what he's taught me. And what I'm applying in my practice. He was talking to his college students about the importance of values and of being simple and kind and humble. Be humble, be harmless, be upright, forbearing, have no pretense, and be free from the bondage of desire. You know, that saying was really what was the core of what he was teaching these young boys.
It touched you?
It didn't touch me. It was upsetting to me.
Oh.
Here I was, a young psychiatrist, thinking that the way to live is to fully experience all of your drives and interests and desires, to have them all fulfilled and gratified.
Mm-hmm.
And hearing somebody talk like this made me feel like it was like the 17th century, that it was very restrictive and constrictive, and I was very upset by it.
Like unnatural self-denial or something like that?
Like that, and like someone just preaching some very simplistic thing. I came all the way from, and I hear somebody saying, just be good, you know, try to be good, and don't give in to fads, don't let your hair grow long and big beards and all this and tight pants. Just be a good human being, simple and humble. So I thought, what kind of simplistic idea is this? I thought I would like to hear something very complicated and very sophisticated, and I was very upset and I wanted to leave. So I was at some distance from Swami. It was many walls of a house separated, and he was surrounded by people who obviously loved what he was saying and wanted to be close to him. And I was thinking that I would have to leave, and before I knew it, he was in front of me with these sparkling eyes and this smile that... I'd never seen. It just captivated me. It just made
me... You know, I heard someone say, no man can smile like Swami. And how true it is.
Oh, it's... You can't describe it, because it's not a human being. It is so full of love that you are absorbed in
that's
it.
Right.
All of a sudden, you lose yourself in it.
Absolutely.
And he gave me some...
So you lost yourself at that moment.
Lost myself. He gave me two pieces of candy, and he said, sweets, eat. And I felt all of my... troubles just melt like that. I could understand then that there's a level of spirituality that was dominated all of our feeling system. What we consider our feelings, sadness and pains and upsetness and frustrations, can be washed. It was washed just like that, just because, just from Swami's smile. So
You felt that way at that moment?
That continues to just astound me. As a psychiatrist, I said, what happened to those feelings of angst that I almost took pride in? You know, oh my God, I'm such a suffering human being. It's so terrible. But within a second, it was completely, and I was a childish giggle, like a pup. And I've been after Swami, barking at his heels and wanting him to pet me ever since. You
know, okay, now let me come to you as a professional. Actually, I would like to talk more about this, maybe some other time. You come here often anyway. This is really relating to the human mind. And you see, this is a question I can't ask everybody, and only very few people like you are available who know what the Western concept of mind is and who has also been exposed to Swami's teachings about the human mind. So my question to you is, do you see any contradiction between the two, or do you see partial overlap? How do you perceive it?
Well, both ideas about mind, the Vedantic idea of the inner instrument, which is generally considered the mind, and the Western idea about mind, they're very similar in many ways. There are desires, there are feelings, there are thoughts, there is a capacity for reason, there is some analytic capacity, problem-solving capacity.
Now, that is the operational aspect. Please tell us whether the Western philosophy has any special role for the mind as opposed to what Eastern philosophy has. You know, in Eastern philosophy, you say mind is an instrument given to you by God for this,
yes,
this.
Yes.
Do you have that kind of approach in Western philosophy?
Well, the difference, it seems to me, is that in the West, we're considered the mind and the body. So you're considered the mind and the body. The idea that you're not the mind and the body is like, an unusual, almost psychotic idea.
Yes.
So, but in the East, the idea that you're not the mind and you're not the body, and that there are higher levels of mind, which are defined clearer by Swami and in Vedanta, higher levels, buddhi, for instance, this idea of conscience. In fact, I was very interested when Swami drew attention to a diagram of what conscience is. Conscience is made up of, I think one of the Upanishads said this, and Swami drew reference to, faith, yoga or balance or sense control, truth, rityam, or the balance, the unity of thought, word, and deed, and the striving after the great declaration, tatwamasi, I and the other are one, I am that. This aspect that our conscience, our higher aspect, is made up of these elements, and that faith is an important part of it, and sense control and balance and truth. And well, this is completely absent, and that when the conscience is highly defined and purified, that it is capable of visualizing the light from the Atma, that it can see the Atma. Well, we don't know anything in the West about what Atma is, or that we are actually divine, and that mind, there's aspects of mind, but one of the most important is that it can be a stumbling block on the way to realizing your true reality.
But let me ask you a couple of questions in this context. For example, the word conscience is known to Western people. I mean, people talk about, I follow my conscience and things like that. And then people talk about the human spirit, especially in relation to adventure and achieving the impossible. So maybe Buddhi and Atma are known to the West, but in different terms, maybe not in such greater depth. And after all, you remember Shakespeare says, above all, to thine own self be true. So he implicitly, unknowingly perhaps, recognized that there is a self somewhere sitting inside. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, Yes, and mystics and artists intuitively grasp that. But the cold, hard science of psychiatry, you know,
I know what you're talking
about. Doesn't actually define that. And they don't define the idea of spirit, that there's a spirit inside you. That I've never seen any
yes,
kind
I
of
remember.
Definition.
I think it was Watson, perhaps, who said that mind is a meat machine. That's probably a pretty brusque way of putting it.
Probably in the West, it's very much associated with the body. So the body and the mind are considered interwoven. But the idea that there is our true identity is a divine identity. Of course, when my first contacts with Swami, it became very, very clear that he at least had a extension way beyond what we understood by Western definitions of mind.
So can I put it like this, that the hardcore scientist and the intellectual in the West does not go beyond the brain. The mystics understand the mind and that it is something which has got divine overtones perhaps. And Swami identifies mind as the derivative of this Atma, which is the universal spirit. So he amplifies and takes it to its ultimate. Is that the way to put it? Would you agree with that?
Yes, and there are many psychologists and psychiatrists who are interested in trying to make this integration between spirituality and psychiatry. So there's a lot of people thinking this way.
When you say they want to integrate spirituality and psychiatry, what is their definition of spirituality?
Well, that there's something beyond mind as we understand it, that there is a higher level of being, an intuitiveness, perhaps a divine nature of man, that the great knowledge from the greats like Buddha and Jesus should be integrated into the general information from psychiatry. Because when I went through psychiatry, I wondered, I would ask people, why isn't Jesus and Buddha and the great saints, why don't we make any effort at understanding this relationship? Well, there's just not that interest for some reason. But there are people now in many fields, in many different facets of psychiatry and psychology that are interested in that and so are trying to integrate that.
Is it just academic interest or is it an interest directed towards developing new methods of treating mental diseases?
Well, I think at the second that there are people who are interested in what does yoga have to do, what does hatha yoga have to do with it, what does Patanjali's mm-hmm. eight steps have to do, what does good works have to do with it. You know, they're trying to integrate spiritual technique for achieving higher levels of consciousness with Western techniques for helping people with mental anguish.
Well, this brings me to a direct question. Do you use any of Swami's teachings in treating your patients? And if so, how?
Well,
I hope it's not an
no. This is a wonderful question because once one meets Swami, you enter into this very deep inquiry. What is its relationship to my life, and how am I expressing it? Because you just don't want to let that wash off your back. It's once you see something like an experience Swami. So, and of course, I've done a lot of thinking about how it's integrated. I would start with something that seems so simple, but is vastly important, obviously, and that is being nice, respecting the other person. For me, the spiritual technique of seeing Swami in the other and respecting Swami mm-hmm. in the other, and actually listening to them, and to look at how that person is living his life and his or her life, and are they practicing good values and doing their duty. You know, just taking a look at the basics, because there are many different levels to Swami's teaching, and it's very, very complicated and very esoteric. But Swami is over and over again, for years and years, at that level, Satya Dharma Shanti Prema Ahimsa. Satya Dharma Shanti. Are we just basically good people?
That's right.
So, I mean, and he over and over amplifies on it and never gets tired telling us. And we listen and then we go out and do the opposite in the next minute. So when are we going to listen and learn? You know, for instance, Simple thing like, I had a patient come in who was very primitive, meaning spoke primitive cuss words. Her movements were very agitated. She lived a very disorganized life. She was had a number of men in her house, and
Was she an educated lady?
She was fairly educated. She was a nurse, but she had just dropped down into the level of a demon, it looked like. She had a lot of psychological problem and a lot of physical problem, and she just seemed to lose all faith and all hope, and she was just cussing like a sailor. Just terrible. And the first thing I said was, look at, you can't talk that way here. We have to just talk respectfully. And she said, Doc, you're a psychiatrist. You're not my father. No, so I said, father, mother, whatever, it's not good for you. It's not good to speak that way. It's actually a very bad thing for you. Good speech is extremely important. Good speech controls the mind, relates ourselves to higher conscience, a way of having deep respect for life. You have to speak nicely in here. And she says, I excuse me, I've never been talked to like that. And I said, you're welcome to leave. You know, you don't have to be here. But if you're going to be here, you have to talk nice. And then we just had that one agreement, you have to talk nice. And so she would come in and she would just talk nicer. That's it. She wouldn't swear. And if she swore, I says, I told you about that. You shouldn't be talking like that. Or shouldn't be talking like that. And she said, I think it was because of one of the medicines that I was talking like that, she said. It couldn't, because as soon as I stopped the medicine, this one medicine, I'm talking a little nicer. She couldn't really bring herself to say, thank you, doctor, for at least telling me to speak nicely, you know, and a little respectful. See, simple thing like that is profound. We're thinking of all kinds of higher techniques, and there are higher techniques, the meditative techniques and all this. But I once read where Swami was saying, you know, somebody came up to me after 50 years of meditation and said, I haven't felt anything different. I says, what a waste that is for that person. What is he talking about? He says, first of all, you can't just go up to and be a high meditator. You first have to know how to have good values, and you have to have sense control, and you have to know then how to sit quietly, and you have to know how to watch your breath, and you have to take
the sense of Patanjali's.
Yes, that you just don't go to the eighth step immediately like this.
Now, coming back to this lady whom you try to get to talk to you nicely, did she improve afterwards?
It's still early. The improvement is that she's not talking like that, and she knows that when she comes into the office, there's a certain level of respect. Another thing, for instance, here's another lady that came to see me, was working as a nurse in a nurse position, had a traumatic event, developed all kinds of aches and pains and sadness, and felt that her life was useless from then on. Mm-hmm. And all she would do was come in and complain and complain and complain. And then after she saw I wasn't going to fight with her, that we needed a little time to just show that I respect and liked her. This is very, very important, Swami's teaching about that, to be respectful and to listen and to... Then I just said, because she'd tried so many other techniques and she was filled with so much medicine, I just said, have you ever had religious feeling, spiritual feeling in your life? She said she'd been brought up a certain way. I says, do you have a little altar in your home? Just to give a little awareness, bring awareness, mm-hmm. just a little bit to simple thing like that. Because this world is filled with darkness. And just to bring awareness to this. So she said, no, I don't have an. I said, do you have an altar in your house? It's the first time she talked to me and asked me a question. Mm-hmm. Because she was just complaining and self-absorbed. Yeah. Do you have an altar in your house? I said, yes. I even have an altar in here. She says, where is it? I said, well, you see the statue here? Mm-hmm. This is a statue of, and this represents, the name is Vishnu, mm-hmm. protector. And I, when I look at that, I think of God's protective powers, and I'm asking him to protect us and keep us safe. This is the first time she would allow me to say something sweet. I said I had to say it about him, but I said some sweet words to her. Uh-huh. And then she started asking me, well, how should I make my altar, and where should I make my altar, and what should I put on my altar, and all of this. She started. She's a very, very sick lady, but this is how spirituality, it's amazing. I once read from a psychologist, I can't recall the name right now, that people that are in pain and suffering have spiritual experience. And the strange thing is that many deeply neurotic people, or people who are troubled from disturbed relationships that keep haunting them, they have spiritual experience that are authentic. They have more authentic experiences, even though psychiatrists would be apt to think that certain experiences that people are having, because they're poor, they're downtrodden and hurting, the love of God is so sweet and so vast that he does come to people, especially
the poor.
So when you
spoke to her kindly and nicely, that really sort of triggered her off, did it?
Well, I could feel for the first time a love experience that was generated through the talking about Vishnu. That was, and you could feel that she was receiving it. So sometimes people don't tell you.
That is the basics of Swami, I mean, but love all.
Love all and serve them. And it can come in the most subtle way, this most subtle way.
Okay, that prompts me to ask a question. Supposing you are not using this method, which is really the best method, and you are doing it the professional standard way of a Western psychiatrist, how would you have dealt with her? I mean, well, I just want to see the extraordinary difference between the absolutely simple and beautiful way of dealing with people and the convoluted professional way.
Well, I don't know if, you know, we have to give...
Not you. So let's say she went to some other shrink.
Yes,
how would you have treated her?
But, you know, we have to say that all of these people are human beings. The therapists are good people. And they're all... it's amazing how so many are searching. So that what they're doing is, if they're trying to be real, you know, and pretense away in their heart-to-heart, and many therapists are, then they do try to talk with the person, try to get real. They do actually try to get real with the person. And
so,
I wouldn't call this
they do this intuitively, whereas you did it based on Swami's direct teachings and experience of Swami.
That's the idea that it's not a method. It is a way of living. So it's not a method that one's doing. One is just trying to talk to a person, trying to get to a level where it's real. You once were telling me how in teaching a college course, you could see how people, when they start talking to each other in front of others, perhaps, that they become a little unreal and
that's
a little
true,
robot. So the idea is how to be real and to the pretense away and to let the child, you know, because all of us, we may have highfalutin ideas and concepts and theories, but really, when you get down to it, we're children, and the basic love that we share is potent, very potent. To get that way with people, to be innocent with people and be able to share that. To talk about, though, how a therapist may deal with post-traumatic stress, because this lady had post-traumatic stress. They may talk about, what was the experience that you had at the time of the injury, and try to desensitize their feeling about this feeling and that feeling. They may try to encourage a person to be a little bit more full in their activities and learn how to reduce stress. And some of these stress reduction techniques are very similar to Swami's teaching, having to do with regulating the breath and regulating the thought to nice thinking, so that many of these have been incorporated into...
But Swami's teaching puts it in a proper framework and perspective.
Swami's teaching makes you realize that you are the... you see, everything in front of you is a reflection of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that what you're trying to do is, if there's something that you dislike, you're trying to empty yourself of that, so you become open and honest. And if there's something you like, you try to be empty of that, and you try to be the other person. And in that way, realize that I and the other person are one, and you try to see where the pain is, and you try to empty it out of you, try to experience it with the person and empty it out of yourself. This kind of an abstract way of talking about it, but when you're with Swami, he's teaching you a certain way of dealing with sense control, dealing with desire, of dealing with thoughts, so that when you're with the other person, you're trying to practice being empty and reverent. And if something gets in the way, to realize that it's Swami in the form of the other person that's bringing it out of you, and that you're trying to empty yourself. And if you are practicing that yourself. You're telling the other person, you're teaching the other person how to do this also, that what they've seen, they have to learn not to excite themselves too much, not to deaden themselves too much. They have to learn to have reverence for that.
So you would say that Swami has helped you professionally also?
Oh, there, Swami has helped every not only helped, he is every aspect of my
that
life.
That is true, but you know, at a mundane level.
It's completely, whatever I've learned in psychiatry is from the practicing of Swami, of Swami's teachings, and trying to put them to practice. He gives us everything.
Let me ask you something else that relates not to individuals but to society as a whole, and this is a problem that has become rather important, especially after the so-called September 11th incident. Generally speaking, I find it a bit strange. You know, the West is technologically so advanced, intellectually so advanced, scientifically so advanced, people are very brilliant, and all that. They have so much accomplishment behind them. But yet, some of the things that they do seem to be contradictory. In fact, you wonder, how can an intelligent person do that? Let me just give you one simple example. Today, there is a lot of emphasis on building up economy through consumption, consumerism, shall I say. And consumerism is being built up and built up and built up with no ceiling. But this is dangerous to planet Earth, and the Club of Rome warned about it maybe in the 60s or early 70s, I don't remember the date. And it is obvious, yet why do people shut their eyes to the obvious? And these are intelligent people. I mean, this goes on everywhere, whether it's in scientific research or political planning, military policy making, finance, whatever. All these people are brilliant, but they wear blinkers. Why is that?
Well, Swami's teaching is simple, I think, about this, that man is divine himself. He's pure love. But we don't know that. And the key is the mind. If we turn our mind to divinity, it's a way of opening us to freedom. And if we turn the mind to the world, it locks us. The mind is very, very powerful. So if we turn our mind to the world, we are in a dungeon. We're locked into an inescapable jail. And it is filled with desire and greed and all the enemies, lust, anger, pride, greed, hatred, attachment. All of these roam there as the gods of this world, the worldly life. As soon as you feel that it is desire, an attachment to outside objects that brings gratification, as soon as you believe that and you start chasing that, there is no end to it.
Desire is the blind spot.
Well, the thought that outside objects bring gratification. You know, there's just a simple psychological experiment that shows that gratification isn't from outside objects.
Yes.
All you have to do is hypnotize somebody who wanted a nice new car, and they're sitting in a shabby old chair, and you tell them that they're in a nice new car, and they're very happy. So where's the happiness? It's not from the object. It's all from inside. So the question is how to find the happiness inside, not how to accumulate a lot of goods. But that simple understanding is lacking in the Kali Yuga. We believe that the object outside is what brings us gratification. So you see the people on Wall Street, and you see the people in the stock market, and you see the people who are heads of agencies, and there's no end to it. Swami's simple little statement that the fulfillment of desire breeds further desire. That's simple like that. Unfulfilled desire leads to further birth. That is, you cannot just tear yourself away.
Yes.
You cannot suppress everything and repress everything and just be a robot. But the trick is that the way out is by offering everything to divinity. Now, that is a very deep and vast subject. How do you do this? How do you release yourself into divinity? This is a very, very... But the first part of it is the fulfillment of desire leads to further desire. Once you turn yourself into the world, the mind is very strong, and it binds itself. It is, and you are then into a excuse the expression, hell if you keep following selfish accumulation of objects under the false belief that gratification of desire brings happiness. This is a false idea, and it's very hard for people to give that up. One of the, as a psychiatrist, one of the things that is fascinating to me is that as you challenge this, that you challenge your attachments to external things, first it looks like it's simple. You know, Swami challenges you by first helping you get over inconvenience and discomfort. Well, come see me at Prashanti, see if you can take the car ride. You know, or just see if you can take the plane ride. See if you can just, how strong you're, and so you have to have some discipline to do this. So it's not easy to do, to challenge, the mind just wants to be satisfied all the time. Then you try to take yourself away from some of the easier, sensual desires. I'm not going to eat as much, and I'm not going to watch as much TV. Now, these are simple ones, but who has control? In the West, they're gorging and gorging, and they're watching television like crazy. So then you say a little bit deeper, you're really false to think that your name or your form, your fame or your fortune, your family or your friends, your power or your position, your all of that, your prestige, is nothing. Well, if somebody loses even one of those, to lose your position or to lose your money, it strikes you with terror, absolute terror. So that then even deeper than that, all of this is transient, and everything that is in the external world is passing, and it's all passing like a cloud. It's all a game. To really see this brings on what I consider a very deep primal fear, which I've called mortal fear. Mm-hmm. To see that everything is transient and passing. And not only that, Swami has told me many times, probably told you, everything is nothing.
That's
and awful. Nothing is
everything.
Well, to experience the nothingness in the external world, that all of the what you desire and all of that is nothing, to actually feel the nothingness, is profoundly frightening. Only love is a power. If you must cultivate love to take you through these stages of giving up and surrendering, because it's only after sacrificing all of this, not by progeny and not by money by position, but only by sacrifice. So only by going through all of that and seeing all of that is nothing. You must hold on to Swami's robe to go through that. It's a very, very, very frightening.
So we hope more people will come and hold on to his robe.
Well, without this, then the world will destroy itself, because we're locked now in a level of terror and destruction that I can't see how any of us can get out of by our worldly thoughts, by our human thoughts.
Sometimes Swami does, of course, without projecting himself, things that we don't even dream of. Take the case of Russia, for example. You know, I remember how it was in the 60s and 70s. We would be fearing all the time a nuclear holocaust. Then all of a sudden things have changed, and today we see so many Russians.
That's right.
Giving interview to Russians morning and evening. And there are more Russians here now than ever before. 10 years ago, I wonder whether you ever saw a Russian.
Well, I never saw one.
So maybe something will happen. But talking of Russia, you have been to Russia several times. So
yes.
Why don't you tell us something about what you saw?
Well, most of my experience with Russia had to do, I think, with teaching me something about Swami's love, something personal about my own wants and desires. And that would be very long to discuss that aspect of what it taught me internally. But the first time I went to Russia, I wondered...
Which year was that?
This was about 1991, I think, mm-hmm. maybe 90.
That was still in the communist period?
No, I think it was Perestroika was going on, and it was opening up.
Okay, it was opening.
And I asked Swami.
It was still USSR at that time.
I don't know.
Okay. It doesn't matter. So you said you asked
well,
Swami.
Well, see, what happened was I was here at Brithaven, and somebody gave me the Russian translation of the my first book, The Holy Man and the Psychiatrist. So I brought it to Swami and said, Swami, because I'm idealistic, and I said, can I go to Russia and find a printer for this? I didn't know anybody in Russia or anything, you know. But I'm just an innocent person believing that if he said yes, he would do it for me. So he thought a minute, and he said, why don't you have it done in Chicago? And it happened that the translator of this, of the Russian translator, was from Chicago. And I didn't know. I mean, it was unusual that he would know that. So I said, but Swami, it would be easier if I found a publishing company in the country. You wouldn't have to ship it over. So I'm trying to teach Swami something or tell him or improving. So he thought a moment and he said, okay, go. He was just letting me go through my own karma, you know, myself. He wasn't going to. And I was stupid enough to believe that I could improve on Swami at that point. This is what I mean. He was teaching me something.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how long? When should I go? He said, why wait? So he was just speeding me along. Well, I then was struck with the reality of it. I didn't know anybody in Russia. I didn't know any publisher. How was I going to go there? But my first two phone calls trying to make contact just were flubbed terribly. It was a terrible nothing. And then the third one, I hit upon somebody who was trying to develop relationship with Russia, had been there many, many times. It was one of those unusual side coincidences, you know. And so I was in Russia very quickly. Well, at that time, I wondered how in the world would Swami's devotees develop in this country, because there was no Swami devotee, and they didn't know what this book meant at all, you know. So, and I wondered how would it happen, because it would be a miracle to think that all of a sudden in this country, which was very poor and so many troubles, would I ever be able to sit in a group and hear Om Ganesha Charanam? Would I ever be in a situation like that? Could it ever happen? And I don't know how the master does it, but it wasn't until
he
maybe
sure does it though.
But he does it, and everybody and he never lets on how he does it or who's doing it or any. But we all know that it's him.
And next time you went, you saw something totally out of this world.
Well, then the next time is when the Russians invited me to be a speaker. My wife and I to be speaker at their conference, and we went there.
Which
and
year was that?
This was 3 years back. Mm-hmm. And they met us at the airport, and they took care of us, and they sang to us, and they loved us. And every day we spoke at a different devotee's home, and the home was clean, and it smelled of nice incense, and the kids were taken care of. And it was so beautiful to see Swami's influence and to see his teaching about being good and being clean and honest and all that, how it was taking hold. And in the evening, we would speak at a large gathering where they would have people from the community. And then we took part in their large conference in Moscow. And there in the early morning, sitting on this old, tattered wooden floor, sitting with about 300 Russian, the Om started. And just tears came, because all of a sudden I saw so many brothers and sisters chanting Om together and having Swami's picture.
Can you tell us how it happened? Because, you know, in America there was Hislop, in Australia there was Murphy. How did it happen in Russia? Not that it requires anybody, but out of curiosity, I'm asking you.
You know,
this.
I just don't know. I didn't follow that straight. I don't know how. All of a sudden,
but
whoa,
it has happened.
But it has happened. And to be sitting then with brothers and sisters, hearing the same bhajan, the same Om, the same love, the same respect for the teaching, and all of that was just breathtaking to see.
That was in Moscow?
In Moscow. To see, how did it take seed? And how did it develop like that? It's
you know,
a miracle.
I've seen once a group of devotees, they were wearing a scarf, Siberia. So Swami has gone all the way to Siberia. And they come from Kazakhstan.
Well, was it Siberia? Siberia?
No, that's a good one. I've not heard that before. I think it has become that.
It has,
no.
Yes. That's
and I believe there are big centers in Leningrad, now St. Petersburg.
Yes, yes, that's where I was.
And Ukraine too.
Ukraine. Well, they were at the conference in Moscow. They were from all over the Urals, from Siberia, from all over places I had never even heard of. And the amount of time that they would take, days and days to travel, penniless, and to get to the place, and just to be with Sai devotees,
and
heartwarming.
Don't you think that is the real power of love?
Who can do that? Who can do that? And who can put you in the biggest mystery? And it's always vital and exciting. There's always something happening to frighten us and to excite us. And to he's just full of drama always full of drama. You don't know what he's going to do next.
No, I agree with you. You go to a strange country and suddenly you hear familiar bhajans. You feel you are at home. You don't feel you are in a different place at all. It's so wonderful.
And to sense that it's a world seeding of something that is understood internationally, that it's understood, it's a universal language of love, that's understood in all the languages and all the customs, and it's going over, breaking through different boundaries of socioeconomic, country, religion, that it has this power, this quality of the love, which is so remarkable. You see it in a smile, you're just absorbed, but to feel that that can radiate out and cross all boundary.
It's just amazing.
People that you never thought you'd ever have anything to do with. Even in your center, the person you dislike the most, you know you'd never have anything to do. You'd marvel at how we could be brought together and even try to learn how to get along with each other. What marvelous love is bringing us into this experiment.
I heard Bob Bazzani saying once, how wonderful it is to be able to see it all happen right before our eyes.
Oh. It's so much of Swami's. Oh, what grace it's been for us. What grace it's been.
Well, I would like to thank you at this point of time for sharing so many of your thoughts with us. This is not the first, only time you're going to be here. You're going to be here again because there are so many things I would like to talk to you about. For example, about Dr. Hislop. He was an extraordinary person and he had an extraordinary relationship with Swami. You must have known him well, didn't you?
Well, he lived very close to us.
Okay.
And I knew him mostly. I knew him for many years. We served on the council together from the time of his inception in 1975. Mm-hmm. I've been to many meetings with him and loved him and spoke with him frequently. But the closest was at the time of his dying. To see this great devotee go through his death was something... you know, sometimes you see the greatness of the divine master through some of the... majesty of the devotee, some of the good
right,
qualities
right,
of the devotee,
right.
And that was what we saw in Dr. Hislop as he passed on.
I remember a yogi describing death. He said, ordinary people are afraid of death. A yogi, he says, oh yes, my mission is over. I have to pack up and leave and start it elsewhere. He's not afraid of death.
Yes,
he welcomes it. In fact, he controls his death, he says. So it must have been so with his love.
Well, I don't know if he controlled it, but he had this great detachment. I wondered, I would sit with him and I'd say, shouldn't you be more angry? You know, Swami allowed him to go through his passing, watching himself lose his strength over about 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's hard for us.
Yes,
one time I said to Jack, what is harder? Going to Japan, he had just gone to Japan and gave 30 talks in 10 days, something like that. And he was dying at that time. He didn't know he was dying. Or to get out of bed today. And he says, well, old chap, he would call me that, old chap, it's harder to get out of bed today. So he would have to see himself go, his mind, he knew that his mind wasn't as, and he would even say when we would talk, he says, you know, my mind just isn't as clear. I'm sorry, Sam, I can't think quite as well, but this is as much as I can tell and talk now. And I said, well, aren't you angry? And he would look up. He said, should I be angry? With such innocence, I said, I guess not, Jack. Don't be angry. And one of the sweetest things as he was dying, he said, Sam, I hope that I'm not disappointing you. And I said, what do you mean by that? He says, I want you to feel warm. How did he put this? To be disappointed in the way that I'm dying. You know, he wanted to be helpful and loving to me. He wanted to show me how a person should die. And he was telling me, it was the sweetest moment, I hope I'm not disappointing. I says, Jack, my brother, how could you disappoint me? I had to hug him, you know. How could you disappoint? You could never disappoint me. He was a wonderful man. And at the end of his life, this is the strongest experience I've ever seen of Om. A number of us came at about the same time one evening, and Jack was now in a coma, and he was struggling with his breathing. And I wanted to play a tape of bhajans, because I didn't know. I knew there were prescribed chanting and whatnot that Vedic pundits would know, but I didn't know those things. So I wanted to play a tape. His tape recorder was broken, so I just started to chant Om. Mm-hmm. His mantra was Om Sai Ram. Mm-hmm. And so I just, Om, like that. Om, right at the foot of his bed. And then the others came around the bed and we began to chant Om. And within three or four ohms, he was like, we could see him recognize it. I mean, even in his coma, he recognized it, and his body just, although he had been struggling, his body just went like this, and off he went into the ohm. We could feel him with us in the ohm. It just, it was like releasing himself into his mantra. It was so, and we just all were just like pins and needles, you know, feeling that we were chanting this ohm and that he was in it with us. It was an extraordinary passing.
I'll add a little footnote to that. Sometime after that, in the morning, I was sitting in the veranda. Morning interviews and all were over, and Swami came and he was standing there and he was talking to somebody from the US, I don't remember who it was. And he asked him, "Where's your friend?" And this man said, "Swami, which friend?" "Hislop, Hislop." And he didn't answer, he just looked up. Then Swami said, "Where is your friend?" Then he said, "Swami has gone up." Swami smiled and said, "No, he has not gone up, he has come to me." So I thought that was a wonderful way of wrapping it up.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, and we look forward to the pleasure of having you with us again. And I'm sure what you said today is going to delight millions of devotees when they hear it. Thank you. Sai Ram.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Sai Ram.
Soham, soham, dhyan karo. करो सोहम ब्रह्मा सोहम विष्णु
Girdhara Bye.